something of the change that the Enlightenment made about attitudes towards the Jews leading to Jewish emancipation. And I talked last time about that event of 1711, the burning of the Frankfurt ghetto, and the reactions to that burning, which still mixes medieval attitudes with emerging attitudes of the Enlightenment. It still believes that you should take no money from Jews, that Jews shouldn't be allowed to pray in your house, that they shouldn't rebuild the synagogue because it is a work of the devil. And yet, on the other hand, it extended the idea of charity now to the Jews as well. That is, to sheltering them and that kind of thing. But if you look at the end of the century, you have the breakthrough. The breakthrough comes with a very famous work, the other famous work we're dealing with, Wilhelm Christian Dohm's book about the improvement of Jewish citizenship of 1781. Wilhelm Christian Dohm was a clergyman, but he was also a man of the Enlightenment, a close friend of Moses Mendelssohn, as a matter of fact. His book will be of vast importance, and what has happened in that century is very illuminating. One thing that happened between 1711 and 1781 is that the Enlightenment had triumphed among these intellectuals and among the administrators of government. This rationalism and optimism shines, if you like, through Dohm's remark. I must confess, he says, that I cannot conceive of a human group which is incapable of improvement. That is a typically Enlightenment statement. But I cannot conceive of any human group that isn't capable of improvement. That's one argument. But there's a second argument that he makes too, and that is taken from Adam Smith. And that also will have a long future before it. The theories of Adam Smith. For Adam Smith had held that the power of the state increases with the number of its productive citizens. The more productive citizens you have, the greater the power of the state. The argument is therefore that the Jews must become productive citizens to increase the power of the state. At the moment, the Jews are merely consumers. That is to say, they are merely traders, commercial people, usurers, to use the contemporary term. But Jews must be made productive in order to increase the power of the state. That, as I said, is an application from Adam Smith. The idea that no group is beyond improvement is an application from the Enlightenment. Dohm has both arguments within it. And yet he believes that for Jews this improvement was going to be difficult. For generations of oppression had made the Jews so utterly degenerate that it would need three or four generations until they could be brought to the level of other cultures, human beings. What Dohm was thinking of was not the wealthy circle around Moses Mendelssohn. Dohm was, indeed he had to be, concerned with the Jewish masses. That is why his statement about centuries of oppression, that is why his statement about degeneration, what he looked at was the ghetto, degeneration. That is why he believed it would take three or four generations of improvement. There were three obstacles to Jewish emancipation. Jewish particularism, and above all the idea of the chosen people, did not fit in, of course, with the Enlightenment at all. Jewish hostility towards Christians, which meant that Jews could not eat at the same table with Christians. This will be, in fact, a very big argument from now on in. The Jews could not even eat with Christians, which was interpreted as contempt for Christians. And finally, their commercial structure, that they were indeed parasites and not productive, because they went in not for productive trade, come back to that, but for commerce, and usually small-time commerce. Now these obstacles for Dome were not the fault of the Jews, far from it. They were the fault of historical development. It were the fault of the Jews, he would not argue for emancipation. They are, in the Enlightenment way, the lingering of historical superstition. Still they exist. And here he touches on a general concern, which I want to illustrate to you from France as well, so that you can see how general it is. In 1806, Napoleon submitted to the French Jewish community a series of questions. What were these questions which Napoleon officially submitted to the Jewish community? One concerned the possibility of intermarriage. You believe it or you reject it. The second was usury, taken only from non-Jews. Are you allowed to take usury from Jews as well, or only from non-Jews? And finally, to sum it up, do you consider the French as brothers or foreigners? Now, Napoleon's questions are very similar to Dome's in direction. Jewish separatism is an issue. In Napoleon's question, do you consider the French as brothers or foreigners, intermarriage, usury, and in Dome's obstacles as well? The answer to that, the true answer to that, will of course come from your reading in Cuts. And you will get in Cuts the answer from inside the Jewish community. It is clear that the obstacles of Dome and the questions of Napoleon had some footing in reality. The whole process of Jewish emancipation was geared to overcoming these questions of separateness. And if you read the tortured answers which the Jewish notables gave to Napoleon, you will see that it is a very real question. For the Jewish notables were badly split in their answers. And the answers that they gave in the end were highly casuistic. In other words, they did not really give Napoleon a straight answer. They couldn't. Because this separateness, in a sense, was built in to ghetto civilization and, in a sense, to this whole tradition. So that even that answer was extremely ambivalent. Now, what was the solution? For Dome, the solution is also the solution for everyone else, because his tract became normative, as you will see. Dome's solution was everyone else. They were based on what? They were based on the environmentalism of the Enlightenment. The solution of Dome was based, to be more specific, on the anthropology of Lamarck, which had captured the Enlightenment imagination. The anthropology of Lamarck was an environmental explanation of evolution. That is to say, evolution could be controlled by controlling the environment. To tell you the most famous example, which you always get, the giraffe's neck became elongated because what it ate was so high up. Don't laugh, who knows the truth? I do. So, what you have to learn is doubt. You really don't doubt. You think you're such great radicals, but you don't doubt. Doubt anything, really, you know. You really don't doubt. Certain truths, unfortunately, you accept. On faith. Lamarck may well have been right. You don't know? I don't. But anyway, it is this environmentalism, the explanation of evolution, which Dome took up. So what is his concrete solution? Your vast influence. First of all, Jews must leave their old profession and become farmers and artisans. On this I must elaborate a little. Why must Jews become peasants and artisans? Dorn puts it as follows. I believe that the problem of the moral and civic improvement of the Jews would completely disappear within 50 years if it were possible to turn the majority of the Jews into farmer and artisan. At the same time, Dorn idealizes the artisan class. What does he say about the artisan? His soul is troubled by neither nagging fears nor delusive hopes. He enjoys the present with a pure and perfect joy. His strenuous labor keeps him healthy. He is honest and just. The artisan and the peasant are for Dorn the noble savage. You will find in general that by the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th, the artisan and the peasant had replaced Rousseau's so-called noble savage as the ideal of happiness. Therefore, Jews must become artisans and farmers to get contact with the earth, contact with nature, to renew themselves in the whole ideal of the Enlightenment, to leave the ghetto, to leave the town and the urbanism, the filth of the ghetto, as they would put it, and small-time usurious commerce, and get in touch with the land and the earth, become peasants and artisans. That was the Arcadia of Dorn, and for many Jews, this was to remain so, for many Jews and Gentiles. Let me make that clear, for it is the opposite of commercial and intellectual activity. What Dorn proposed, out of the ideas of the Enlightenment, will become for Jews the antitype. The peasant and the craftsman are the antitype of the puny intellectual Jew. Throughout the century, you find the following phenomenon. When rich Jews found charity for orphans, orphans' homes. These orphans' homes throughout the 19th century are geared to making the Jewish orphans into peasants or soldiers. Come back to the soldiers in a minute. Into peasants or soldiers. Throughout the century, that is the idea, to make the young Jews, the orphans, into peasants or soldiers. This solution out of the Enlightenment foreshadows, of course, the Zionist Max Nordau's much later distinction, famous distinction between muscle Jews and coffee house Jews, a distinction that will become of vast importance. But this is where it begins, in the Enlightenment. And this, of course, will remain also in Zionism. The idea taken from this Arcadia, taken from this idea, that life on the soil makes you especially moral because you are cleared to nature. And at the same time, this is about as far as you can flee from the ghetto. This is the antitype, the Aryan Jew behind the plow. Where have you seen that before? We shall come to that. But what I want to make clear to you now, I don't want to go ahead with it. I'm just saying because we'll come to this eventually. What I'm saying to you now is that that solution to emancipation became a solution not only for Christians, but for Jews as well. The Jew must cease to be a trader, a man who does trade. And indeed, for Karl Marx, as you know, Judaism and usury were the same eventually, as we shall see. But so it was for Dorn. So it was for many enlightened Jews. Jews must cease to be traders, and they must be farmers and artisans. For in that case, you would abolish the Jew as a type, as the ghetto type. Secondly, Jews must break out of their Hebrew culture, learn German or French, accommodate their schools to the German curriculum. Now, Dome would not touch religious instruction. But like Moses Mendelssohn in many ways, Jewish religious instruction is just one now among many subjects in school. And most subjects are what we call secular German or French subjects. In other words, school must have the same curriculum as Mendelssohn's Jewish preschool did, as I mentioned last time. And therefore, religion becomes just one subject of instruction. That is clear. And thirdly, and in a way crucial, military service is the greatest school for citizenship. Therefore, Jews must be able to take part in military service. That has its echo, because as I said later, the orphans, Jewish orphans, were trained either as peasants or as soldiers. Military service as a school of citizens. Now, these proposals were general. For example, when the Abbé Grégoire submitted to the Revolutionary French Assembly his law, which was adopted eventually, emancipating the Jews in France, the basis of his own work was Dome's work. In other words, he took a draft from Dome. And all that the Abbé Grégoire's tracts are to the French Revolutionary Assembly is in many ways Dome translated into French. Now, I have told the theory. How did the practice look like? And that we must come to now. What did it work in practice? And here the Austrian Empire, with its nearly million Jews, most of them living, as you know, in Galicia, was of vast importance. In 1782, 1 year before Mendelssohn's tract, 1 year after Dome, the Emperor Joseph II, who thought of himself as an enlightened person, issued his famous Toleranzpatent. That is his famous act of toleration. The first. His famous act of toleration of 1781 for the Jews of the Austrian Empire. Now, what is this act of toleration like? It abolished a whole series of humiliating restrictions. Above all, it abolished that famous restriction that whenever Jews went into a city, they had to pay the tax, a city tax, like animals. They had to pay a city tax. There's a famous thing preserved in the city of Berlin where it says one day there were taxed an entrance to the city 5 cows, 3 steers, and 5 Jews. Among them, by the way, Moses Mendelssohn. So that what you have is the abolishing of this perhaps very humiliating tax on Jews movement. Also, all trade was opened, but this is always not quite true, because most traditional trades were controlled by the guilds. The guilds were religious Christian associations, and no Jew could crash a guild. They had a Christian oath for entrance, and therefore opening all trade to Jews meant, in effect, new trade. That has a lot to do with the social composition of Jews from then on. New trades, not the old established guild-bound trades. So that opening trades to Jews meant only, in effect, allowing them to establish new trades on the margin of the economic system, because the guilds controlled the essential trade as yet into the 19th century, and the guilds from the Middle Ages were religious organizations with, after all, a Christian oath of entry. But what is important in the edict is the program for re-education. For the edict was a charter to re-educate Jews. Now, another humiliating fact of Jewish existence, not only in Austria, was that every Jewish marriage had to be approved by the authority. This was to keep the Jewish population down. Every Jewish marriage had to be approved by the authority. Joseph II did not abolish it, but he used it for his purpose of education. Permission for marriage will now be granted to Jews automatically, provided both partners had visited a German Jewish elementary school. In other words, there would be no Jewish marriages permitted, unless both partners had in fact attended a state school and have gotten out of Jewish schools with Jewish curriculum. Secondly, all business transactions had to be made in the German language, not Hebrew. That would force Jews to learn German. That would force them to learn German. That was inspected. All business transactions must be kept in the German language. And finally, Jewish communal autonomy and Jewish rabbinical jurisdiction was abolished. That is to say, the Jewish community is a self-contained unit with rabbinical jurisdiction over it. That was abolished. However, even when toleration was used, as it was used here, for the education of the Jews, Vienna was still closed to them. No Jew could settle in Vienna, but neither could any Protestant. No Protestant and Jew could settle in Vienna, for Vienna was Catholic, and Catholicism was the dominant religion of the empire. So Vienna, the chief city, was kept totally Catholic as a symbol of Catholicism. No Protestant and Jew could settle. And finally, military service was compulsory for Jews. There you see it again. This led to riots in Galicia. This led to serious disalarm. The military service led to serious disturbances in Galicia. But it was enforced under Dohm's educational ideas. Military service is the best education for citizenship. We must summarize, therefore, by saying that Joseph II's toleration was in fact, as all Jewish toleration edicts, a matter of education. The basis was Dohm and the Enlightenment, which I hope I have more or less explained. But there were exceptions to that. In all German states, therefore, between 1791 and 1812, that meant the end of the Jewish Middle Ages. That's what it meant from the Jewish standpoint. In the West, it meant the end of the Jewish Middle Ages. In Eastern Europe, they continued. Education was stressed everywhere. The education edicts of the French Revolution also stressed education. It said that Jews must become artisans, especially apprentices to artisans. In fact, it made it almost compulsory for young Jews to become apprentices to an artisan trade. So you have the same thing really in France with Abbé Grégoire. But the exception is Prussia. The exception is Prussia. That exception is rather interesting. For the exception in Prussia comes from the great Prussian statesman and humanist Wilhelm von Humboldt. Wilhelm von Humboldt, who disagreed with using toleration for educational purposes. The founder of the University of Berlin disagreed with that radically. For Humboldt said that in using toleration to re-educate the Jews, as Dohm said it, and perhaps I can quote it again, he ends his book by saying, let Jews cease to be Jews. That's, of course, the clue. Let Jews cease to be Jews. By which he meant abrogate the title, abrogate the ghetto, Let Jews become civilized people, by which he meant people of the Enlightenment, peasants and others. That's what they had to be. Humboldt disagreed with that, for he said, quite rightly, I think, the state is illegal, not an educational institution. And the state must not be transformed, as Joseph II did it, from a legal institution to an educational institution. Men must be treated according to their individuality, not to their religion and their origins. His critique is, I think, very clear. He said, these people like Dohm and Joseph II are people of the Enlightenment. They believe in individualism, and yet they treat the Jews as a group. There is a contradiction here. People must be treated as individuals, and not, after all, by their religion or their origins. And then he raises a very sensible question. How can one judge whether Jews have become better people? How are you going to judge the results? How are the results going to be judged? And of course, there is no answer to that question, obviously. Clearly, Humboldt here applied his general ideas of the limits of state power to the Jewish problem. He believed in emancipation, for as he puts it, the unnatural position of the Jews demoralizes the nation. He hoped eventually in a complete emancipation of the Jews without preconditions. And then, he said, Jews will inevitably become Christians. This is not as far-fetched when we come back to conversion as we will. This is not far-fetched. Eventually, he said, with complete emancipation, Jews will become Christians. From Humboldt moved in the circle of Mendelssohn's children, who were all baptized and married into the elite of the Romantic movement. So they will all become eventually Christians, but you don't have to educate them that way. The Prussian Emancipation Edict of 1912, known now and then by the name of the Prussian Prime Minister at the time, the Hardenberg Edict, was the only emancipation edict which did not have any educational part to it. The Hardenberg Edict was indeed a complete emancipation, with one exception. The opposition was so great that Hardenberg and Humboldt made one concession to the opposition. They left it to the king to decide whether Jews should enter state offices, whether they could be state officials, like judges, lawyers were state officials, professors, officers in the army. They left it to the king to decide. Now, as a matter of fact, as you will see, the king never decided. And so, as a matter of fact, how it worked out, it was a complete emancipation, except that Jews could not become state officials, which meant, in fact, professors, judges, and officers in the army. The army officers had a Christian oath. That was one of the problems, so that they could never become officers. But otherwise, the emancipation was more complete in Prussia than it was anywhere else. But there was another catch. It applied only to Prussian Jews. What does that mean? It applied only to Jews who had lived in Prussia under royal protection. That is to say, to those who had begun as court Jews living outside the ghetto, and those who had been permitted to live in Prussia under royal protection. In practice, what did that mean? In 1812, it meant, to give you the facts, that about 30,000 Jews were emancipated, and 3,000 were not. 3,000 were newcomers who lived mostly in the eastern corner of Prussia. That is to say, in Posen. In Poznan, as it's called today, it's really Posen. Posen has much greater claim on it. I come from there. So, that what you have therefore here, is it applied to 30,000 and not to 3,000? By 1914, with the rapid rise of the Prussian Jewish population, it applied to about 123,000, and 52,000 were omitted. Now I mention this for a reason, because those who were omitted were in fact going to be the East Jewish problem in Germany. The way the emancipation came about created in Germany a Jewish population that was essentially stateless, that didn't have any nationality, an essentially stateless population. But the vast majority were emancipated. Because the Hardenberg decrees were total, the reaction to it is equally violent. And the reaction to these decrees centered around the problem. Can Jews reform themselves? Don't we need enforced measures of education, as you had in Austria and in France? Do we not need enforced measures of education? And because we do not have enforced measures of education, aren't the Jews then a state within a state? This accusation of a state within a state, which you can now see from separatism, was first raised by Fichte as rector of the newly founded University of Berlin. But it became, and we shall come back to it as such, a general accusation. Why? And here we must look at France again for a minute. At Napoleon, what he did. For Napoleon did not accept the emancipation of the French Revolution. For Napoleon insisted on treating the Jews as a nation. What Napoleon did, and what made a tremendous impression on all those opposed to emancipation, he called the Jewish notables together once more and called them the Sanhedrin. That is, after the old biblical Jewish court, he revived the Sanhedrin in a sort of mixture of romanticism, but also because he didn't accept emancipation in reality, Napoleon. He treated the Jews as a nation, calling the Sanhedrin and asking the same question that he asked before. Are the French your brothers or foreigners? The same kind of question he asked. And why? Why? Because he had his own Eastern Jewish problem. His Eastern Jewish problem was called Alsace and Lorraine. For in Alsace and Lorraine resided the majority of French Jews, and they resided in Alsace and Lorraine under ghetto conditions. So that, in effect, I'll come back to that, while the Germans had the ghetto in the frontier region, France had the ghetto centrally in Alsace and Lorraine. And it is for that reason that it was always present that Napoleon refused, not only refused emancipation, but indeed put new restrictions upon the Jews, mostly upon Jewish commerce. He really believed that Jews were usurers, Napoleon. And so he promulgated a series of so-called anti-usury legislation, which hit only Jews, and which was designed with Alsace and Lorraine in mind. So when we look at Napoleon, the fact that there in France, emancipation was for a period in fact abrogated. It is because there, in a sense, the ghetto was central, and in Germany it was on a frontier. It is only in 1815 when the Bourbon monarchy was restored, then emancipation was restored to the French Jews. This may seem to you at the moment odd, I know, because the Bourbons are reactionary in common parlance. But there is, and I must say this now, no necessary connection between reactionary and anti-Semitic. There is not a necessary connection. And there wasn't with the restored Bourbons. Not at all. Louis XVIII was very friendly to Jews. And it is almost of his own free will that he restored a Jewish emancipation in France. But, the fact that Napoleon treated the Jews as a nation, still at that late date, made a tremendous impression throughout Europe. That he himself abrogated emancipation is going to be very fateful in the end throughout Europe. It also made a tremendous impression. Clearly, in emancipation then, to summarize it, there are several problems involved from the very beginning. First of all, the stereotype of the Jew remains alive. The idea is to cease to be a Jew. That means, as far as the stereotype is concerned, if you refuse to cease to be a Jew, you are in fact the stereotype. I shall come back to the stereotype in a little later. But the stereotype I mean, the outward and inward stereotype. The 18th century is the century, for example, of the development of the Jewish nose and other stereotypes. So the stereotype remains. The stereotype remains. And you will see when we come to it that the 18th century, as a matter of fact, has the stereotype in great measure and even develops it. That will remain because of the group idea, because of the idea of re-education. That must be clear. It will remain. This is Voltaire. He didn't hate the individual Jew, but he hated Jews. It was to be changed by education. There is, and I might make that clear now, no racism involved, and there won't be till the end of the century. The Jew must cease to be a Jew, but those who remain deepen the stereotype. They are lost, because it's a matter of individual volition now. They are lost. They are the stereotype. Secondly, but what about the Jews themselves? What about that balance again? For I've given you now an idea of the terms of emancipation. What I've said to you today are the terms of emancipation. You have nothing to say with these terms. These terms were laid down. You could not argue with them, needless to say. The terms of emancipation. What about them? It must be said from the very beginning that many Jews in the West accepted them gladly, for they fitted in with their own idea of the Enlightenment. They attempted, therefore, what we might call to modernize Judaism. To modernize Judaism. And in this, they were encouraged by the ghetto civilization, which from the beginning of the century was slowly spinning over. You must remember something. Frontiers don't exist until 1918. There were no frontiers until 1918. No customs official, no passport official. That didn't exist till 1918. I must make this clear, or you won't understand what happened. There were no way of keeping people out of your state, because there were no frontiers or passports until 1918. So that the ghetto civilization constantly spilled over, and you soon had little ghettos in most of the Western cities, in Paris, in Berlin, in most of the Western cities. And the presence of these little ghettos spurred on, if you like, the indigenous Jews, spurred on the indigenous Jews to modernization. For they, of course, wanted to put a war between themselves as civilized 19th century enlightened people and those who had spilled over from the ghetto and who kept the Orthodox Jewish observance, the Orthodox dress, that is to say the kaftan, the pious, the earlocks, and all of that, which seemed to any enlightened man, whether Jew or Gentile, a survival of the Middle Ages. And they wanted to be abreast. So that in this modernization, in this acceptance of Dome's ideas, in that acceptance of education and the idea that Jews must be re-educated to peasants and craftsmen, the West European Jews saw some sense, for he too faced the problem. These ghetto Jews in Alsace-Lorraine, in the Polish Pale, spilling over into the cities, they were making anti-Semitism. For them, I'm telling it to you from their view, for them, and therefore they faced the same problem. The only way to face it was to modernize. Modernize and modernize. And perhaps you will not only be accepted, but perhaps you might also bring, and I now quote from a contemporary doctrine, the masses of Jews of Eastern Europe to the cultural standards of the West. And because in the Enlightenment there was a definite Jungteam, a definite binding up between economic prosperity and cultural standard, the Western Jews and Gentiles thought that the East European Jewish masses would not get out of their poverty until they had become modern and enlightened. In other words, it was generally thought that Orthodox Jewish religion was an obstacle not only to enlightenment but also to prosperity. So that you have these two things bound up, and therefore you have among Jews themselves the urge now to modernize, the acceptance of these conditions of emancipation, the acceptance of emancipation. Let me summarize it this way, and that'll make it clear to you. The Western Jews now were just as happy and embarrassed in Gentile society as, let us say, in England, the first fellows from working class background who came into an Oxford or Cambridge common room. It's much the same thing. It's the same parallel. They were just as embarrassed in Gentile society, the newly emancipated Jew, as a chap from working class origin in Oxford and Cambridge. Much the same idea and much the same reaction. They made every effort. First of all, as I told you before, the name Jew was dropped. For example, until 1810, the Jewish journal Sulamit carried the subtitle, A Journal for the Promotion of Culture and Humanity Among the Jewish Nation. After 1810, it promoted culture and humanity among the Israelites. Similarly, as I said, the word Jew was dropped and the word Mosaic was substituted. You know, one of the most interesting things in teaching this course, which I enjoy hugely, is your reactions. You know? Really. It's going to be very interesting as I go on. Because I come from this background that I'm telling you. And I've never understood American Jews. Maybe I will now. But the question is, your reaction will be very interesting. Really. Israelite was dropped and Mosaic was substituted. I told you the shock I had when I found somebody first calling himself a Jew. Really. True. All over the West, even in Poland, the very center of the Jewish religion, the office of rabbi, was changing. Under this impulse of modernity. A treatise from Poland, from Lemberg, of 1823 tells us What must a rabbi do? A rabbi must first of all preach the love of country, the willing response of everyone to military service. And it is here that you have this famous symbolism under which I was brought up. Namely, when the new synagogue in Potsdam was built, the Prussian eagle was put over the ark. This Prussian eagle over the ark of the Potsdam synagogue will be a symbol which will last and will have some importance into the Nazi times, will have some importance to the attempted Nazi-Jewish understanding to which I will come later. In other words, this was the modernization. The rabbi must, the acceptance of the conditions of emancipation. The rabbi must first preach love of country and military service, and you can see why. You can see why. From your perspective, it doesn't make sense. From the perspective of 1823, it makes a great deal of sense. That is to say, those were the roads to citizenship. Those were the roads to acceptance. Those were the roads to assimilation. So that we must say finally, therefore, that what happened is that Western Jews accepted these conditions of assimilation. For them, re-education meant modernity. Re-education meant modernity. They accepted it. They furthered it. They tried to modernize their institutions, but to modernize in certain ways. And to that response, I will go on with that response next time. But I want to see, and I'll answer questions next time, but I want to see now anybody who is a graduate student on it.